I'm Maury Kelman. My brother is Rabbi J. Kelman, who is in Europe right now. So unless somebody is introducing, I'll give a couple of seconds and then I will get started. Okay. All right. So again, I'll give a quick introduction myself. So first of all, welcome everybody. I think this year the learning today is being in memory of Rabbi Mandelbaum, I think I saw, who it's also the finishing of the yahrzeit of my father today. So I also dedicate the shiur in memory of my father, Rav Chaim Yosef and Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who those of you in Toronto, I'm sure, knew. I was a major force in Toronto, and it's a tremendous zechut to hopefully try to follow in some of his ways. Okay, so I'm going to begin now. I'm going to start because of this week's parsha, of course, is first of all, just it's a parsha of transition. We have the last two parshiot of Shlach and Chukat, Shlach and Korach, which of course have the major rebellions, both beginning with the rebellion of the Meraglim and the followers that rose up against Moshe and Aaron and Kalev and Yoshua. And we all know the story there. The Jews are condemned to wander in the desert. It's actually, we'll come up to this in a moment. Who died in the desert? That's going to be a point. We'll talk about it in a few minutes as well. And then, of course, we have Korach, and there's a machloka, there's a dispute whether Korach took place right after the decree against the Meraglim and the Jews having to stay in the desert, which would make a lot of sense. Korach capitalized on the anger of the Jewish people that they would have to die. They wouldn't be able to end up in Israel. That's one opinion. And then that's the question of Ein Mukdam U'Meuchar B'Torah, whether the Torah follows chronologically or whether this took place at a different time. So assuming that the Torah is going in a chronological order, that we have, again, the Meraglim followed by Korach, which would take place in the second year of the Jewish people. Again, if you recall, the Jewish people were supposed to enter the land of Israel right away. And after the Mishkan was finished, was inaugurated, it would have been, they were a few days of journey away, and that would have been it. That would have been the end of history, really. That's what the Gemara and the Darim tells us, that had the Jewish people not sinned and they entered Israel, that would have been the end of history, as it were. There's a famous article in the 80s by Francis Fukuyama, the end of history, when after the downfall of the Iron Curtain, the world was going to be finished in terms of any drama. Everything would be great from now on. Fortunately, it hasn't worked out that way. And as we should all, every time that we're learning, every time we're doing something, we should continue to pray for the situation in Israel, continue to pray for the hostages. It really should be on our mind all the time. And so the history did not end, definitely. And unfortunately, the same thing happened to the Jewish people in the desert. The Gemara had said that if the Jewish people had gone in and not sinned, then all we would have had in Tanakh was the five books of Moshe, of the Torah, and Yoshua. That's it, right? It would have been a lot less for us to learn, a lot of less interesting things, but it obviously would have been a much more glorious and rosy Jewish history. So, but that didn't happen. And so what happens between the second year, when the Meraglim are told that, and the Jewish people are told they can't enter the land of Israel, to this week's Parsha, right? We know that in this week's Parsha, it's going to be our topic, the death of Miriam, especially the death of Aaron. What's going on in between? So Rav Soloveitchik famously said that what was going on was there was dying. That was it. That was there weren't a lot of masa'ot. If you look at the journeys of the Jewish people, most of them took place in the beginning, first year, and then the last year, really. And during the intermediate years, there weren't that many journeys. It's not like the Jews were not picking up every day. It was very few. So what was the major topic? And this is also, the rabbis say that there was no real communication between God and Moshe during this time period. Again, the Torah doesn't record anything. And so that's why the Torah begins with the Zot Chukat Torah, begins with the Para Aduma, it begins with all the laws that relate to death and how we are become tahor from the tumah, right? The pure, we were purified from the tumah. Again, pure tumah is not really impurity. There's no real good English translation. It's not, it doesn't convey, it's the opposite of tahara. But when we come in contact with death, so obviously we have to go, as the Torah tells us this week, we have to go through the process of the mixture of the ashes of the red heifer. So that's really a nod to what was happening during these 38 years. And that's why it takes place here. Otherwise, it would make more sense. The same way we have the Korbanot in the last 2 weeks parsha, also we have the sacrifices. They don't seem to be in the proper place, right? We're not going to discuss that right now. The last two parshiot, but this also, what is this doing here? It should be perhaps in the book of Vayikra, which discusses more the sacrifices, but it's here because this is telling us that was going on in during these intermediate, the 38 years of wandering. And then we come to last year. And then we come to the death of Miriam, which precedes, of course, the terrible incident, which we don't fully understand, which could also be a number of shiurim as well. But I figure that's being talked about so much. Just to quote, I think, the Shadal and maybe the Or HaChaim, everyone tries to, there's so many different reasons that people find for Moshe's sin. It's like we're making him into a much worse person, right? You find this sin, that sin. Everybody has their different interpretations. I'm not going to discuss that now, but I want to talk about really the triumvirate, really, and with a focus on Miriam, of Aaron, Moshe, Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe. Because there's a lot to talk about here as well. We'll just really do the Rashi Prakim, some of the major ideas, again, with the focus really on Miriam, because it really is, unfortunately, in throughout history, you don't find too many triumvirates like this that have such great unity among each other. We know that when you have co-heads and different people, they vie for leadership. Each one generally doesn't want to give up on their own, even if it's for good reasons, but often ego and power come into play and usually don't have very successful outcomes when you have more than one person who are part of the leadership. But here we have this incredible model of leadership, and they happen to be siblings, of course, Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe. And we'll talk maybe briefly a little bit about, of course, there is one lacuna in this, and that's the end of the portion of Balotcha when Miriam and Aaron speak against Moshe. We'll talk about that maybe briefly. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, we have this incredible model of leadership. So I want to just really focus, like I said, to talk about Miriam, because also she often, we don't talk about her often as much as she really, we really should, and the greatness that she commands. She's the first woman in the Torah that's called a Nivia, right? Sarah is a Nivia as well. You know, there are, how many, anybody knows for the first 20 points of the game, how many women Niviot does the Gemara say there were?
Seven,
correct. There are seven women and 48 male Nevi'im, but that doesn't mean that there weren't other Nevi'im. But when the Gemara talks about these Nevi'im, these 55 prophets, we're talking for posterity. All of these Nevi'im, these prophets had sent to say for posterity with other people. They could tell you who's going to win the Blue Jay game. I don't know what happened today. Well, tomorrow, who's going to win the Blue Jay game? Who's going to win the Yankee? That's not a Navi that we need to know about, obviously. We're talking about Nevi'im for posterity. So Miriam is the first woman. Sarah was a Nevi'ah as well. She was a prophetess, but Miriam is the first that is called Vatikach Miriam HaNevi'ah. She's called a prophetess in the actual Torah. So let's take a look a little bit about some of the sources really that relate to Miriam. So we have, of course, the beginning of Shmot, where we have the first source here, Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim Lemuel Dot, the king of Egypt speaks to the Hebrew midwives, and we don't know their name. I mean, we're told their names are Shifra and Pua, but we don't really know who they are. So if you look, I'll read the English to make it simpler for everybody. So one says that these midwives were a woman and a daughter. One says that they were a daughter-in-law and a mother-in-law. So according to the one that says they were a mother and daughter, the women were Yocheved, right, the mother of Moshe and Aaron, and her daughter Miriam. And according to the other opinion, it's referring to Yocheved and Elisheva, who is the wife of Aaron, which would seem to pose a bit of a problem in terms of the ages, right? Because we don't know exactly. We have a tradition that Miriam was 7 years older than Moshe, and Moshe and Aaron were 3 years apart, right? The Aaron died at 123. We know that Moshe died at 120. So it would be a little difficult that Aaron could be married at this point, but okay. But in any event, well, that's a, we'll won't get into that right now. So, but we all grow up to learn the first part of this Gemara, that this is a reference to Miriam. So why is she called so Pua? And then the Gemara continues, Pua is a Miriam, right? So then why is she called Miriam? If you look in the English here, why is she called Pua? Because she would make a comforting sound. She would she would, that was a ooh, like a cooing type of sound. As she would remove the child from the womb of the mother. Alternatively, the Yur Pua is related to one of the verbs that describes speaking, as she would speak, Pua, through divine inspiration. And she would say, and this is the idea that she was a Nivia when she was a young girl already. In the future, my mother will give birth to a son who will save the Jewish people. So you see, the Gemara is already attributing at a very young age. Again, Miriam would be, according to the tradition that we have, would be 7 years old, and she was already a Nivia. She was already a prophetess who had this idea, greater insight than her parents, that they would have a son who would become Moshe. Then the Gemara continues again. This the Gemara skips around a little bit between its page Yud Aleph 11b and up to 13 Yud Gimel Amud Aleph 13a in Sota. You have all various Gemaras that relate to Miriam and her actions, and again what happened preceding the Jewish people leaving Egypt. Okay, so then the Gemara tells us, again, we'll continue in English, elsewhere the verse states with regard to Miriam, and Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, that's what it calls her, Achot Aaron, right? It says Achot Aaron. So the Gemara immediately asks the question you're all thinking of now as well. What do you mean that she took a timbrel, right? So the Gemara says, why is she called the sister of Aaron? She's not the sister of Moshe, right? If anything, she's more associated with Moshe, right? We just finished saying in the Gemara that she was the one that saved Moshe, that she, and we'll see in a second that she was the one that brought Yocheved and her parents, Yocheved and Amram, together. So why is she only referred to as the sister of Aaron? So this is what we just said as well. Rav Amram says, that Rav says, and some say Rav Nachman said, this teaches that Miriam already prophesied when she was still the sister of only Aaron, before Moshe was born. So she could have been 6 years old. She was 5 years old, 6 years old. So this is a... So the Gemara clearly has this idea that we see there's a certain greatness to Miriam that I don't know. Maybe somebody here is aware. I don't know. I mean, we have by Yirmiyahu, right? But when Yirmiyahu, it's going to be one of the Haftorah very soon, when God comes to Yirmiyahu to appoint him as to become a prophet. So he says, and Yirmiyahu doesn't want to, like similar to Moshe. That's a common theme as well, that the Nevi'im are modest. They don't want to have to go into this. They're also probably smart. They know what's in store for them, especially Yirmiyahu, who had a very difficult life. So God says, the terem etzarcha babeta, right? That God says that even in your mother's womb, I had chosen you, that I had chosen you to be the Navi. But I don't know that we have any other real cases of prophets at such a young age prophesying, right? We know there's a question when was Avram, when did he recognize God, right? Then there's one idea that he was three, but generally the other opinions are, I think, 40 and 48, but that was just a recognition of God. That wasn't as a prophet. So again, maybe somebody here is aware of another prophet that prophesies at a young age, but this is, so right away she stands out. I mean, she stands out for being the first woman to be called, given the appellation of a prophet, and already at a young age, there's something very special about her. And again, then this, and we're talking about this because we see already the close connection from such a young age between Aaron, Miriam, and Moshe, right? She's called Achot Aaron at a very young age, and she, as we're going to see right this second, she, as many of you are aware, is the reason that that Moshe is around, right? So we have here, we'll continue here in the English, the man, right? The Torah tells us, it doesn't give names. It just says, a man went from the house of Levi. So we don't know their names right away. So it's only later. So the Gemara picks up, what does it mean he went? He went at the advice of his daughter. Amram was the head of the Sanhedrin, right? He was the one of the major Jewish leaders at the point in Egypt. And when he saw that, obviously not a, not the Sanhedrin in the way that the Sanhedrin later on becomes the major judiciary body of the Jewish people, but he was the head of the, he was one of the leaders. And when he saw that when Pharaoh was throwing the Jewish boys into the Nile, he said, why bring children into the world for nothing? When am I going to have a child? And they're going to kill him. He separated from his wife and all the men in generation followed example. He was the leader. If they see that he separates from his wife, they all separate from their wives. His daughter Miriam said, Father, your decree is worse than Pharaoh's. He only decreed against the males, and you've decreed against males and females, right? We all, I'm sure all, we're all familiar with this. You're going much worse than Pharaoh. Basically she says, you are righteous. Surely your decree will come about. Amram listened and reunited with his wife, and all the men followed his example and reunited with their wives. So you see here again, this greatness that the Talmud is already attributing to Miriam from a young age. And again, she would be at most, it would seem 6 years old. It's maybe seven at this point, but six, because if she was 7 years older than Moshe, then this is 9 months before. So she's a very young girl, and she's got this tremendous wisdom, and her father listens to her. As we're going to see now, this is something beautiful. I think it's a tremendous model that we have, we can take in our lives as well. Just the, that, again, we know that, that men and women in Judaism are both on the highest planes, but sometimes, you know, we have, there's an idea that women aren't given the proper kavod that that they should. I don't agree with that, and we see here as well that that's clearly not true with the case of Miriam. Again, and in this sense, Miriam and Amram really are role models for a father and a daughter. So the Gemara says, if Amram remarried Rechavet, rather than say he took a daughter for a wife, a daughter of Levi, right? Then it should have said he returned, right? Hichzir, right? He had separated, but this wasn't new. So Rabbi Yehuda Bar Zvina says he performed an act of marriage. It was a, he made a wedding. He sat on a palankion, that's an apirion in the Gemara, some sort of plank, right? And Aaron and Miriam danced before her, and the ministering angel said, a joyful mother of children. So it's, again, it's a beautiful image, you know, this idea of Aaron and Miriam dancing together, these young children bringing joy to their parents. Just to stop for a moment, to think of this image, you know, think of, you know, just to go back, you know, 3,500 years, and to think of Amram taking back his wife, listening to a six-year-old daughter, however old she was, and saying, yes, my daughter is right. She has more sense than I have sense, in terms of more vision, not in a negative way. She has more vision. She's a prophetess. She was prophesying at a young age, and therefore I'm not going to reject her. I'm going to listen to my own daughter who's got this tremendous insight and prophecy, and just to think of the dancing in front of them, going to their re-wedding, you know, their second wedding, and Aaron and Miriam dancing again. Again, you see also from a young age, this image of Miriam, and again, it's a foreshadowing, of course, and as you're reading this, all of us are thinking, we know that Miriam later on is going to be singing and dancing with the women when they cross the Red Sea. So the Gemara here, our rabbis are telling us that this was part of who Miriam was. She was a dancer. She was a uniter. She was a prophet. And again, and the beauty of her relationship with Aaron as well. You know, she was the Achot Aaron, and they were dancing together in front of their parents. And the ministry of the angels recognize this, and Ema Ben Smecha, right? That's the famous, the words that we have in our Hallel, that a joyful mother of children, that what naches to have from such children. And then Moshe is not even in the world. Moshe is not in the world yet. And the naches that Amram and Yocheved have from Miriam and Aaron. Okay, so the Gemara tells us, it continues again, this all in the Gemara and Sota. And as a child, Miriam would say, in the future, my mother will give birth to her son who will save the Jewish people. And once Moshe was born, the entire house was filled with light, right? But that's what Rashi points out when talking about Moshe as well. Her father arose and kissed her on her head. He said to her, my daughter, your prophecy has been fulfilled. Again, just think of the image, you know, the father filled with joy, kissing his daughter, recognizing her greatness. And you can just, you know, think of that beauty, the unity between father and daughter. He said to her, my daughter, your prophecy has been fulfilled. And once they put him into the river, however, right, her father arose and hit her on her head. Hopefully, oh, it doesn't mean hit. I mean, hopefully gave her a little punch, you know, like this. That's what I understand. Gave her a little punch over here, right? that I mean, really, it's the truth is, it's in the Hebrews, right? It's that's what it means. It's a little like utfachal rosha, right? He gave a little knock on the head and said, "There, my daughter, where's your prophecy? Right? You just told me that this son is going to save the Jewish people. We're putting him in the river. That's it. We're not going to see him anymore. What happened to your prophecy?" And therefore, the verse says, "And the sister stood afar off." Right? It says, "Vatetasav achotom erachok." Right? She goes to the bank of the river to see. What is she going to see? To know what bilandim? To know what will be the ultimate resolution of her prophecy? Right? So she's also wondering. So you can see this young girl who is confused now. Right? Doesn't say that she doesn't answer him back. Absolutely, Dad. Don't worry. Everything. She's unsure. She's unsure what's going to happen. Imagine she has that faith. But she can't answer for sure. So she goes off to look. She's a young girl. She's going off to see what's going to happen to the prophecy. Okay, I'm gonna switch gears a little bit in terms of the jumping ahead now to a couple of rabbinic statements about Miriam and maybe some of the challenges that she have, as we'll see here. So in the same Gemara, in the tractate of Sota, the Gemara says that in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles, Chalev, the son of Chetzron, begot children of Azuva, his wife, right? That he said his wife, Chalev was married to Azuva, and mentions the sons, Yesher, Yeshov of Ardon. So the Gemara now asks, and the Gemara says that Azuva, which means forsaken, is a reference to Miriam, that Kalev married Miriam, but she was called Azuba. So why is she called Azuba? And why is she called Azuba? As everyone initially abandoned her, did not want to marry her because she was sickly and unattractive. Okay. We know that the Torah generally does not talk about, unless, and there are a few cases when it's germane to the story, the Torah generally does not point out physical characteristics of people. Again, doesn't talk if they're pretty, they're handsome, this and that. There are cases, like I said. We don't know anything about Miriam, right? There's no reason to think that she was sickly, but this is what the tradition tells us, that she had, that she was, that there, and as Rashi points out in the Gemara, that people didn't want to marry her. She wasn't such an attractive woman. Okay? So the Gemara again continues the verse of the Shadays, and Kalev, the son of Chetzron, begot children. It says holid, right? He begot, right? It's as if he gave birth almost. The Gemara asks, why use the term holid, begot? But doesn't the verse state that he married her? Rabbi Yochanan says, this teaches us that with regard to anyone who marries a woman for the sake of heaven, as he married her due to her righteousness without concern for appearance, the verse describes him credit as if he gave birth to her. Right, it's so the Gemara is pointing out again just an interesting tidbit. Again, we can think about this maybe later, if what influence this may have had on anything or not. But bottom line is that Miriam was not considered to be like some of the other women that are mentioned as being very beautiful. And Kalev is given tremendous credit that he wasn't in, that's not a, that wasn't a consideration. He married her because she was a righteous woman. And again, Mark clearly, as it says here, is telling us, what are the important things in life and what we should be looking for in a marriage as well. Not to be, beholden to just to looks and appearance, but to look at the character of the person. And obviously in this sense, Miriam was on the highest of level. But the Gemara then, it turns a little bit, okay? So that it says that Yeriot Shiupanea Domin Li Yeriot, right? The same verse refers to Miriam as Yeriot, and the Gemara says that her face was pallid, was like curtains, okay? But we're going to see in a minute that this changes, perhaps, right? So the Gemara then continues, and these were her sons, right? Do not read it Baneha, rather Boneha, her builders. In other words, we'll add the explanation here. The rest of the names in the verse are not the names of her children, but rather appellations for 100, whose marriage there built her, as it were. The first appellation for Kalev, again, I'm going to skip some of this. Okay? It's saying that the names of her sons were actually a nickname for Kalev, that he was a great person, and that he, by marrying her also, he, like Mara says, he helped build her as well. He gave her strength as well. Okay, and I'll just skip to the last three lines over here. And this, and some say, because the face of his Miriam became beautiful like a rose vered, right? That's one of the names that's given to, according to this, Ardon, the Ardon, right? The Ardon could be a name that's related to Kalev. And the word in Hebrew, vered, that she becomes beautiful, that she, that her face becomes beautiful like a rose after she gets married. Again, I don't want to, you know, you can take this on different ways. But I think the main thing that you can take away from the Gemara here is to, it's in the focus on Miriam as a person of deeds, a person of greatness. She didn't impress people, at least at the beginning, with her appearance per se. It was all about her inner greatness that she had. And like I said, we could talk about this and what, you know, in the class that we devote to the Gemara's description of beauty, etc., and physical appearance. So this would play an important role, but that's not the focus of it right now. And in fact, you have a reference to this in the Medrash. This is the next source here. They says, why was her name Miriam? Because of the bitterness, that there was something mar. Okay. And, maybe because she wasn't as pretty. Who knows? You know, that there was something, though, there was something, bitter, that she had to contend with. Okay. So the Gemara here again is saying that it was, things were, you know, on the one hand, the rabbis here again, on the one hand, she's blessed with prophecy from a very young age. She's got this sense of simcha, em habanim sim smecha. She brings happiness to her parents. She brings her parents back. She's the ultimate shadchanit. You know, she brings, she's shadchan. She brings her parents together. But she had to contend maybe with some more shallow issues that maybe other people, would bring up. So again, the rabbis here are pointing out again that Miriam, it wasn't like she was just given a silver spoon. She was, she had her different challenges that she had. Okay. And then we have other references to her names and different appellations given to her. Ephrat is Miriam, right? There's also a reference in this, in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles that according to our rabbis, Ephrat is the name for Miriam as well, right? And I'm not sure if I have the pasuk. Hold on. Yeah, I didn't quote the whole verse up there, but this verse that related to in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles mentions Ephrat. So the Medrash points out Ephrat is Miriam, since Israel is fruitful and multiplied because of her, right? Because we just finished saying Ephrat, Parud in Hebrew, fruitful and multiplied. This is all of Miriam. And then the Midrash says there's another name for Miriam, Achrachel, because all the women went after Achareha, Achara, right, in Hebrew, with celebration dance after the splitting of the Reed Sea. Okay, I just wanted to throw in just an interesting source that we have here. So again, we are in rabbinic sources, we only know Miriam as the main rabbinic source. We know that Miriam is the wife of Kalev. Of Josephus, in antiquities, he has without getting into Josephus and all of his sources, but he was an important source. Clear, it doesn't mean that we take him at everything, and definitely not. We have to take certain grains of salt and many different things, but he has a tradition that she was not married to Kalev. So it says, so long as Moses held his hands erect, the Amalekites were discomforted by the Hebrews. Moses, therefore, unequal to the strain of this extension of his arms, and seeing that as often as he dropped them, so often were his men worsted, bade his brother Aaron, his sister Miriam's husband, who was called Hur, to stand on either side of him to support his hands, and by their aid not suffer them to flag. Okay, so just as an interesting aside. Okay, so we mentioned before the Gemara seems to be foreshadowing what would happen to Miriam as a young girl. Again, the idea of singing and dancing in front of her parents. So the Torah very clearly gives credit to Miriam for the song of the women by after the Reed Sea, okay, but after the party. Again, we just referenced that in the Medrash. That was another of her names, Achrachel, that the women all went after her. Right? The women all went after her, and with they had drums, etc. Okay, and Miriam, of course, says, Batam Miriam, Shir Lashem Kiko Gosus, she gets a few less verses than Moshe, but it's significant again that the main part, the main thrust of that song is to sing a song to God that he saved us, and that the chariots and the horses of the Egyptians fell into the sea. So this is just, I'm going to skip this actually right now. Basically, it just, this is the Targum Yerushalmi that, just goes into a little expanse of what her song was about. It expands upon her song. As you can see, you can just read it quickly yourself, but just expanding a little bit more. Okay. So, just want to get through three other sources, and then we'll come to Aaron, Miriam, and to Moshe together as well. Okay. So the pasuk, the verse we just mentioned, Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron again, took the tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her. So how did the women of this generation know to take tambourines out of Egypt when there was barely enough time to take food? The righteous women of the generation were certain that God would perform miracles in the desert, so they brought the tambourines out of Egypt, right? So this is a whole motif we have as well, that the women really had more faith than the men. I'm not going to quote the next thing Rashi quotes, and it's, which is based on the Talmud in Sota, that many of you are probably aware of, that it was the women. And this really is in sync with what Miriam done. The reason I just mentioning here again is that Miriam seems to be the inspiration for all the other women. Again, as we saw before, it was Miriam that said to her father, gave the prophecy and said, you have to take back Yocheved, and now all the other people followed. And it seems, according to what the Gemara then says later on, that the women in that generation also were of the same mind, that the famous, you can just read it to yourself, the famous Talmudic passage that Rashi quotes here, the idea that the women would go up to the men with their mirrors, right? This is why the kior, the Talmud tells us that the marot hatzovot, that the sink that was made of copper mirrors in the Beit HaMikdash was a reference to the women who use these mirrors to come to their husbands and to say, look how beautiful I am. Again, you're worried about Paro. You don't want to have children. You don't have faith. We have faith. Come. We need to have children and show Paro that we're going to win. So it seems that Miriam really is the whole inspiration for all of this. She did it with her parents, and then the women of her generation do it en masse as well, taking inspiration from the story of Miriam as well. We also know, and this is again, this coming to our Parsha right now, that it was because of Miriam, right? We know that that in the merit of these great siblings, this great triumvirate of Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, we had the merit of the well for Miriam, the Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory for Aaron, and the man, the food in the desert that was in the schut and the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu. So it's because the whole preface to the incident of Moshe and the sin, etc., is all because Miriam dies and the well dries up. There's no more well and there's no more water. What are the Jewish people going to do? So I just wanted to mention a couple of rabbinic teachings about this well of Miriam. So we see here that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot tells us that 10 things are created on the eve of Shabbos at twilight, right? On this no man zone just before Shabbos as well at twilight. And one of them is the mouth of the well, right? That the Pia Be'er, this well of Miriam. So we see already there's certain transcendence, as we'll see in a second as well, both from before time, at the beginning of time, till after time as well. There's something about this well that in the Schut of Miriam. So you see already in Jewish tradition that Miriam plays such an important role, that she really goes back to the 6 days of creation, the well for her, and that we'll see the next thing, that it continues throughout time as well. So that's the Pirkei Avot. Then we have the Medrash in the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. The waters of the well are destined in the end of days. So again, so you see this, the rabbis are clearly making him transcendent of all things from the beginning until the end of days. So if somebody can mute, who's ever on unmute. Okay. So the waters of the well descend in the end of days to come up from under the doorstep of each house and will flow out and become 12 streams corresponding to 12 tribes. And each field, what does this remind you of? What does this remind you of? Right, there's a medrash also about that there are 12 different lanes. 12 different lanes. Who's ever on unmute, please mute. that there were 12 different lanes that the Jewish people went through when they went through the Yam Suf, the Reed Sea. So you have a similar idea here as well. There will be these 12 streams corresponding to the 12 tribes, and each field and vineyard, which is not yielding fruit, will be watered and will yield fruit. And they will enter and cover the Dead Sea and sweeten its waters, right? And it will flow all the way up to Jerusalem. And anyone who is sick will wash in the water and be healed, right? So this beautiful idea. So this Miriam is this transcendent figure from the beginning of time to the end of time. And through her marriage, she's a healing person. She brings husbands and wives together. She heals people. She makes the Dead Sea, her waters, the merit of that Be'er, the well, the Dead Sea will become sweet again. And then we have again the Hamikdavar Rav Nathalie Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great rabbi and Voloshin from the end of the 19th century. So in his commentary, he says, when the Jewish people were in the desert, the well stood beside the tent of meeting, and the officers of Israel dug a stream leading to their tribes. Then the more generous leaders dug smaller streams to cut down the inconvenience and allow for the water to flow directly to their family. It was divine providence that the water would only flow towards someone who was generous, because water is the specific reward for kindness. And so you see this beautiful idea as well, that we know that water in rabbinic literature is of Torah.
Water.
There's the pasuk in the 45th chapter of Yeshayahu, right? It's one of the haftorahs we're going to be reading during the 7 weeks of Nechama, of comfort. Hoy kol tzameh lechulamayim, right? Hoy kol tzameh, who's ever thirsty, go to water. So the Gemara said, what do you mean, go to water? Obviously, if you're thirsty, we don't need a pasuk in Yeshayahu to tell us we should drink water if we're thirsty. So the Gemara says, Ein mayim ela Torah, right? That water, the yam shel Torah, we know that water often is identified with Torah.
Toronto.
But here
Rabbi, can you mute this iPhone person, because she's interrupting your class?
Yeah, I know that. I'm hold
you
on.
Know how to, can you mute her? I don't know who it is. There's no name.
Hold on. Let me see if I can. Yeah. I know. I'm sorry.
Mute everybody.
Yeah, just mute everybody.
I know. When I'm in the shared screen, I'm not sure I know where it is normally, but I can't find it in the shared screen. Okay. I hope maybe they're quieter now. Okay. Hopefully. Okay. Or not. Okay. Give me 1 second. Okay. I'll try to do it as I'm talking. Okay, so yeah, but basically, so again, I think it's a beautiful idea here that water is the idea of kindness, and again, this is the motif we see with Miriam as well. This kind young girl who is bringing people together all the time. Okay, all right. So I'm going to skip. Well, I'm just going to mention briefly, because this is somewhat germane, it is germane again to the whole question of the unity of the triumvirate. So we know, I don't have the sources here on the page here, but we know there are many sources among the rabbis based on the order. If you look in the Torah, sometimes it says Moshe and Aaron, sometimes who Moshe of Aaron, who Aaron the Moshe. Sometimes it says Moshe's name first, sometimes it says Aaron's name first. So the rabbis all point this out to say that this is really, it's connoting the tremendous love and respect that they had for another. And in fact, you have a beautiful idea that Moshe and Aaron, we know, so many of you are probably aware, the famous, difficult, but famous, rabbinic teaching that the sun and the moon were originally created as one size. They were each, the moon was the same size as the sun. They were the exact same size. And the moon complained, how can you have two people with it? Exactly what I start off the class by saying, normally when you have two or more leaders together, they fight with each other. Nobody wants to, everyone wants to outdo the other. The ego comes into place. And from the earliest of time, this is just as a very quick aside, right? When we go into rabbinic teachings, right? So much of rabbinic teachings are just, when you go beyond a little the surface, they're trying to teach us lessons about life, right? So on the one hand, this medrash is very strange, right? The moon complained that it you can't have the same two kings with one crown. One of us has to be crowned the king, right? And then so God said, "You're complaining. I'm gonna make you smaller, and the sun will be the king, as it were." But again, beyond the surface, the Gemara, that rabbinic teaching is telling us about life. It's giving us a lesson that we shouldn't do that, that we have to try to overcome our ego, that yes, you can have two people, and you can have co-chairman of a successful company. It doesn't usually work, but again, but it's telling us to aspire to this and not to be like that sun and the moon. So you have this motif when it comes to Aaron and Moshe, that they are the kapara. They are the atonement for the sun and the moon, that you have these two great people, these two great leaders, Aaron and Moshe, and they're able, they're who Aaron, the Moshe, who Moshe, the Aaron. They each want, you know, I don't know what, I can't remember that cartoon, that it was a Pepe Le Pew or something, those, that cartoon with the, they were the groundhogs after you, no, after you. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. It's a cartoon from many years ago. You know, you have, that's what Moshe, they each want to respect each other, right? And the fact that there's a fascinating rabbinic teaching as well that Moshe should have really been the Kohen Gadol, right? That Moshe should have been the Kohen Gadol. But when he came back from Egypt and God had asked him to speak to Paro and Moshe, he went to, you know, first he said, first he wanted to give kavod to Aaron, that was fine. But then it went further and Moshe, again, he when God again spoke to him to speak to Paro, Moshe hesitated, and he wanted Aaron to do it. So it's a fascinating rabbinic teaching that says that it was at that point that Moshe lost the Kohen Gadol, his ability to be the Kohen, and was given over to Aaron, because really he should have been, right? That raises a whole bunch of other questions for another time, but that's a fascinating, rabbinic teaching. So the bottom line is we see Aaron and Moshe had this beautiful relationship of one another. Moshe again was younger, as we know, as we just finished saying, 3 years younger, and yet Aaron always tried to give him the kavod, always gave him the respect, and Moshe tried to give Aaron the respect. So again, we're not going to go into length right now, but what happened at the end of the Parsha and Balotcha, but when Aaron and Miriam speak against Moshe. And again, it wasn't a malicious type of thing. Again, it was, whether they were trying to have, and again, Miriam seems to be the more the leader when it comes to this, that she had compassion upon Moshe's wife. And again, it doesn't say it's Zipporah. It says she's the Cushite, right? We don't know exactly who she was. And this is what if you look in the English over here, what Rashi quotes as well, that basically they felt they didn't understand the uniqueness of Moshe, right? It wasn't a malicious thing. They just, they thought that Moshe maybe was being, you know, you could think about this as an older brother and sister. And if you think about this really as that relationship, it's hard to think of Aaron, Moshe, and Miriam in regular terms, right? The way we think about our own siblings. It's hard to think about that. But they were human beings, right? They were human beings. So it would make sense with all this tremendous love. And again, and to recognize, you know, as we just finished talking about that, Miriam is responsible for Moshe being alive. Miriam on so many different levels. You know, we didn't go into all the different midrashim and rabbinic teachings about it. It was how Miriam and Miriam Yocheved were connected to Batya, to the daughter of Paro, and arranged for Moshe to be breastfed by Yocheved, etc. So she was like a mini mother to Moshe. So we know tremendous love. So it doesn't make sense that she would speak maliciously against Moshe. You can look upon it just as a possibility that Aaron and in this stage of their life, you know, that Aaron and Miriam were being the older siblings here to Moshe Rabbeinu, just as a possibility, again, to be done the kavshut. And again, they saw that perhaps his wife was having a difficult time, and Moshe should be leading more of a domestic life, and that was their mistake. It wasn't malicious though; it was maybe as a older sibling type of advice, and then God has to tell them, no, you don't fully get it. Moshe is absolutely unique. There's nobody like him. The Chol Beit Neaman, who is the sui generis prophet who has to be on call all the time, so you cannot deal with him like you would with somebody regular. Okay, so. So we see this beautiful relationship. We see the unity that throughout their entire lives of Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. You know, Moshe's missing, though. We know he goes away, obviously, for 40 years. He has to run away from Egypt. So we know that the beautiful reunion that Moshe has with Aaron, and then we can imagine as well with Miriam. And then for 40 years, really, they're the leaders of the Jewish people in that desert. So the question is, and coming really to this week's Parsha, is why, first of all, why does Miriam die? Right? So we know that Moshe and Aaron, the Torah says more than once, and in this week's Parsha, and then later on as well, that Moshe and Aaron died because whatever happened at the rock, that they did not lahakdi sheni, they did not be mekadesh shem shemayim, they did not sanctify me by that rock, and therefore they will not lead the Jewish people into the land of Israel. But this takes place after Miriam dies, right? So why is Miriam not living? Why is she not in the that she not go to Israel? And this the question is amplified more. So I'll actually read to you from a medrash. It's one of the more minor midrashim in terms. It's not so well known. It's not so because it's a medrash espa. It's called, okay. So the question becomes more amplified when we, as the medrash here points out, that the women did, according to the medrash, the women didn't die in the desert. It was the men that died in the desert, right? So they look with me here. The Hebrew came out a little garbled when I cut and paste it here, but okay. We'll read the English. Only she died from all the women that left Egypt. As the women did not die in the desert, as we see in Yoshua, all the people that came out of Egypt that were males, all the men of the war had died. Right? I don't think a lot of people necessarily know this, but not the women. Right? According to the rabbinic teaching, the women did not die in the desert. So why did Miriam die? Of all the women, Miriam? Right, so if you didn't read it yet, if anybody wants to wants to give an idea of why Miriam should die, right? Why of all the women should Miriam die? So again, the second answer we're going to give is really the title of this talk about the unity of Miriam, Aaron, Moshe, and life and death. Okay, so the first reason the Medrash give is this is due to the well that was in her mirror, since it would not be possible that she should live and the well that was in her honor would depart. Okay, so in other words, the Be'er had to stop, right? The Be'er wasn't going to accompany the Jewish people into the land of Israel, right? We know that everything, that the land of Israel, this is a major theme. We mentioned before, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, the idea that the time in the desert was really a supernatural time, right? The Jews were living on miracles. And they were preparing as they were preparing for Israel. They hadn't prepared to live a natural life. Once they came to Israel, there was going to be no more. God will be there. We obviously, God is always there, but the supernatural miracles would stop, right? There's going to be no more. They're not going to wake up every morning and see the clouds of glory and the water. So the well had to stop. So it wouldn't be proper. This is what the Medrash says. It wouldn't be proper that Miriam should outlive the well. We saw before, this is some of the reasons I mentioned the Midrashim before, we see the, you know, Miriam's connection to that well, and how it transcends time. So even though physically it was stopped and when the Jews were approaching Israel, it would come back again. But at that point, it was going to stop. So it wouldn't be appropriate for Miriam to outlive the well. Okay, you could argue with that. You could raise questions. But the other reason I think is really speaks loudly. Okay. An additional reason is that she was equal in greatness to Moshe and Aaron, as all three were the good providers of the Jews. That's a pasuk. They were the parnasim. They were the providers of the Jews. Again, the Gemara and Tanit. And it would not be proper that they should pass away while Miriam lived. Thus she died first. So it's a beautiful idea here. The Midrash is saying that basically they lived their life together. Right, they provided. This is a triumvirate, a great leadership group that managed the incredibly difficult Jewish people. Miriam leading the women, Moshe and Aaron leading the men, and together leading the Jewish people as a whole. And basically, they had to die. Right? I mean, you can give this similar answer really to Moshe and Aaron. Right? But Moshe and Aaron, the Moshe and Aaron were so identified with the people that if the people didn't make it into the land of Israel, then they also shouldn't make it into the land of Israel. Of course, we have the proximate reason, which is the sin at the rock, but on a philosophical level, there's something that is in sync about this. And now on this level of just Miriam, Aaron, Moshe, you couldn't have one going into, if the two are not going to go, it may not be fair. And in that sense, it's not fair to Miriam. You could ask that, you could say. But on the other hand, it is fair because they're so identified together, and one couldn't go into the land of Israel if all three were not going to go in. And that's really what you have in Micha as well. And we're going to basically finish with this. So you have this pasuk in Micha, the sixth chapter. For I brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, and I sent before you Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. Right. So the pasuk in Micha identifies all three of them together. It makes no difference between Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. It gives the opposite order of their chronology. Right. Moshe was the younger, but they're all together. God sends these three. Now, this is who God just didn't send Moshe. Right. We think about Moshe always. God says Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. And Rashi picks up on this, if the last thing we see here, what is their purpose? Moshe is to teach the transmission of the laws, Aaron to atone for the people, and Miriam to instruct the women. So they may have had different roles, right? And this is really, something that continues within Judaism, right? That we have different roles in Judaism. This man does this, this man does that, this woman does this. There are different roles, but they're all the same. The pasuk does not differentiate between them. It makes them really one: Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe. So I think it's just a really, as we read this week, Parshat Chukat, and we mourn the death of Miriam and Aaron. Miriam's yahrzeit, by the way, is anybody? Yud Nisan. She dies on the 10th day of Nisan, 5 days before Pesach. And she's also, what the Talmud says, one of the, I think there's six people the Talmud says died Benishika. We know the famous Aaron, right? Aaron, we always talk about, he died Benishika, with a kiss, the way that he died with his son. He would give his clothes. They went up to Hor Hahar, to this great mountain. And it was this very choreographed death to show that God loved and cared so deeply for Aaron and died with this image of a kiss. Miriam as well died with a kiss, except that's not, I maybe shouldn't point it out, I'm just going to the Gemara though, that it's not sanua. It's not really modest to talk about God giving a kiss to, I mean, you could argue with that also, but okay, but that's the reason given that, Miriam died with a kiss, that she was, and only six people get this appellation throughout history. So, I hope, so I'm focusing on Miriam because I think as the eldest of the children, she was the one, as I think we've seen, and again, there's a lot more we could discuss, obviously, but she's really the one that made the way, that made the path for her siblings, and in that sense, for the Jewish people, right? So Miriam really, in that sense, is, she's responsible for so much of who we are. And just, it's a beautiful relationship, all three of them together. And again, even with that lacuna, the negative speech that Aaron and Miriam had against Moshe, that they come out of it, right? They don't, that's a beautiful message as well. Maybe that's, the Torah includes it to show that, we often sometimes, especially in our culture that we live in now, you make one mistake, we know what can happen. You people don't show forgiveness here. It was a mistake Aaron and Miriam made. But what happens? Kelna Rafanala. Moshe immediately prays for her. He doesn't take it personally. He prays for her with this beautiful prayer that God should give healing to Miriam. Doesn't take any grudges. And that shows the strength of that relationship, the strength of the beautiful relationship of these beautiful siblings. And Miriam really in that sense, sort of in the leadership position as the eldest, instructing and really giving inspiration to her brothers. And in that sense, to the entire Jewish people. So, that's basically it. If anybody has any comments, questions, etc.
I want to say that I enjoyed what you said very much indeed, and it occurred to me that Kohelet, who talks about Divrei Chachamim Akador Banot,
yeah,
and the Midrash says that's Kador Banot, ball games played by daughters. That could really be applying to Miriam as the captain of the team of the three.
Beautiful. Yeah. Okay. That's beautiful. Yeah. I just see the question here. I didn't see the chat before. So I hope I answered your question. Why was Miriam not allowed to go into Arizona and all the other women were allowed? Yes. So there's a good question. And that's the myth. If you have any other reasons, then I'm happy to hear as well. But that in terms of what I saw, that was the only thing. I mean, that was what I thought, just intuitively, that somehow it would be not be right for Miriam to enter if the others didn't. But yeah, that's a beautiful point about Kedar Banot, but of Miriam. So beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Okay, we'll wish you all again. We know that mitatan shel tzadikim are a kapara, that they give atonement, and again, so we should all continue to continue in the ways of Aaron. These are our teachers, Aaron, Miriam, and Moshe. We continue in their ways, in the ways of our parents. Again, I mentioned the words of my father, and we try to do that, and we should again hear Besorot Tovot, good news from Israel, for the hostages should be released, and we should all, I'll be in Israel very soon, Be'ezrat Hashem.
Amen.
Okay. Have a good evening, everybody, and a good Shabbat.
Lila Tov, Tada.
Tada.